continuing this morning on through the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. And it might seem a little bit strange to be preaching from this passage on Christmas Eve, but I think we'll find there's more of a connection here than you might think at first glance. Because we're coming today to the fourth commandment, which is unique in several ways that we're going to look at. And just, we'll start by reading the whole thing, beginning in verse 8 of Exodus chapter 20. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. You, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So we've looked at the first three commandments thus far and seen how they reveal the person of God, the first commandment revealing his unity, characteristic of the Father, the second commandment, his image being characteristic of the Son, and the third commandment, his name being characteristic of the Holy Spirit. The last six commandments deal with our relationships with one another. So this commandment is, I think, sort of a connector. It's not entirely about our relationship with God, and it's not entirely about our relationships with others. Others are mentioned, and of course this is mostly devotion to God. But I think that its position here actually is very pivotal, because I believe that understanding the fourth commandment is very important to understanding the last six. I've actually heard a very famous preacher, and I'm not going to say who it was, I have a lot of respect for him, but I've heard a famous preacher say, we keep all the Ten Commandments except for the fourth one, that no longer applies. And at the time I was like, well, okay, but you know, I've since come to believe that's actually quite wrong. I believe that the fourth commandment applies to us in one sense more fully than it applied to the people to whom it was originally given, because they only got the shadow. We got the reality. So this is actually one of the most important and consequential commandments that God has given us. It's one of the most far-reaching, I'll put it that way. Because it goes way beyond the observance of one day in the week. That was the shadow that was given to them to reflect a far greater reality, which has been given to us in Jesus Christ. But before we get to the fulfillment, I actually want to start by looking back. Because you notice the first imperative in this commandment is the word remember. That is very interesting to me, because I think it shows that a large part of what God is telling us to do actually takes place in our mind. He could have just said, keep the Sabbath day holy. He could have phrased the commandment that way, but he didn't. He said, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. He's talking about something that is supposed to be constantly called to mind, a mindset, if you will, that we are supposed to have as we expand this in its fulfillment. We can see that this is a mindset that we're supposed to have all the time and not only on one day a week. We can also see that this is actually the only commandment that has a historical basis and a historical reference with which it's connected. He gives the commandment and then he says, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So he refers to an event that occurred in the past as the basis for this command that's being given. So I just want to rewind a little bit and go to the end of Genesis 1, where this event that is referred to actually took place. So starting in the 31st verse of Genesis chapter 1, "Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made." I think I used to think of this as a little more arbitrary than it actually is. That is, I think it might be natural to think of God as though, I mean, a human metaphor is kind of being used here, because obviously God does not get tired. But we can sort of latch onto the metaphor and think, well, God worked really hard for 6 days, and on the seventh day he sat down and said, wow, this feels really good. I think I'll bless this day because I feel good having done all this work and resting now, so we'll make the seventh day a day of rest. That isn't actually what's in view here at all, because God is infinite in power, infinite in energy. He doesn't need to take a break. The idea of resting here with regard to God is not one of tiredness or recuperating energy as it would be for us being limited human beings. It is actually the idea of completion. So seven is the number of completion. The seventh day God had finished. That's what the writer of Genesis says using Hebrew parallelism. He created and made. There was an act completed. And that is why he gave us this observance, to commemorate the completion of his creation. Because at that point, it was perfect. God looked at it and said, it is very good. There was nothing lacking in all of God's creation. It was all exactly as it should be, which is the way that it should have stayed. What happened? The fall happened. Rebellion happened. Man's relationship with God was broken. The rest that God had instituted, that is the completion, the perfection, the finishedness, that was all messed up. So, once again, I believe in the first three commandments we've seen God's person revealed. I believe in the fourth commandment, his purpose for mankind is revealed. And he gives it ahead of those last six to show that this is what he actually created us for. He created a rest into which Jesus actually said the Sabbath was made for man. So God ordained a day of rest, not just because he was in a good mood and decided to bless a day, but because he wanted to create a reminder that would come on our calendars every week from now until the end of time. We're reminded, oh, God made a day of rest. Oh, God made a day of rest. That's why we have a 7-day week. Do you know that there is absolutely no astronomic basis for a 7-day week? It is the only element of the human calendar that is true of. Months are based on the cycles of the moon. We have a year, 365 days, because it takes approximately 365 days for us to go around the sun. Why a 7-day week? No one actually knows. I looked it up this morning just to see if secular historians had any idea, and they really don't. They've got to have an answer. So they generally acknowledge it was Judaism, where it was first practiced. And they say, yeah, but the Jews stole it from the Babylonians because they had this thing. But they didn't really. The Babylonians had extra days in their week because they wanted to make it even with the months. They wanted it to match up with the new moons because the moons were very important. They had moon gods and so forth. This idea of a 7-day period that recurs regardless, that has nothing to do with months or years or anything, is actually very strange. It doesn't seem to have any, it doesn't seem to be linked to anything in the natural world that you would say, this is where we got this idea. What's even stranger is the fact that the whole world is now doing it. And that in fact the whole world was doing it before Christianity became the religion of Rome and then the religion of Europe. The Romans actually adopted the Jewish seven-day week in about the first century. They started doing this, which is very strange, because they had their own kind of loosey-goosey. It was almost a little bit like an eight-day week. It had to do with market days, and it was all mixed up. So they started observing the Jewish seven-day week, and then it gradually migrated through Asia all the way to China in one of the early Chinese dynasties around the Middle Ages, and then to Japan. So you've got the entire world now, and I believe this is totally because of God's providence, acknowledging that there are 7 days in a week. Not everybody likes this fact. Rather famously, when the French had their revolution and decided to overthrow everything, including themselves, in the 18th century, they said, no, we're not going to have 7 day weeks anymore. That's Christian. We're doing away with all that. 10 day weeks. There's, 10 fingers on our hands, we're going to make all of this make sense. It's going to be 10 day weeks from now on. And of course, we know how the French Revolution ended and all the people that started it and ended up having their heads chopped off. And it was a horrible catastrophe. And they went back to 7 day weeks. But we haven't given up. The secular humanists get to the Russian Revolution. 5 day weeks didn't work. Okay, 6 day weeks. Six is the number of man. Every sixth day was a state day of rest. That lasted until about 1940, back to 7 day weeks. Nobody could make it work. Why? Is there something magic about the number seven? God ordained it. God says the week's going to be 7 days, the week's going to be 7 days. Yeah. Nothing else is going to work. Even if the second biggest country in the world, actually the biggest by geographic territory, and they had lots of money, and they could make a law, and anyone that wouldn't do it would go to a concentration camp. 6 day weeks. Didn't work. Had to go back to seven. Because God intended to imprint on the very way that we measure time this truth that is so important, I have created a rest. My work is finished. You need to enter into my work. This is not about your works. The commandments that I'm giving you and the commandments that I'm about to give you for how you should treat one another, those have nothing to do with your achieving something on your own. I've already achieved it. That's what God was saying in the fourth commandment. Keep the Sabbath day holy because I've already achieved everything that needs to be done. And you need to remember that. And they were to remember it 1 day a week. He gave them 6 days a week to do their own works. He said, 6 days, you've got 6 days to do your work. The seventh is my day. And you remember the work that I've done. One thing that I think we need to understand about rest is that rest is not the absence of activity. I believe that rest can be a very active thing. Rest, I believe, is best defined as the absence of toil and pain. That is, the absence of the consequences of the fall. What was Adam's curse after he fell? It was, the ground will not yield to you its strength. In other words, you'll work, but you won't get the rewards of that. You will have to squeeze out a living from this ground that will fight you every step of the way with thorns and thistles. What was Eve's curse? It was pain. You won't be able to bring forth children in a smooth and natural way. It will be a struggle. So the curse, sin and the curse brought this struggle, this stress, this toil, this frustration, and all the things that God never intended to be a part of the human experience. He intended for our lives to be restful. It doesn't mean we lie in bed all day long for all eternity. There's purpose. I believe that there's labor. There's applying the faculties that God has given us to the problems in our path and solving those things. I believe there's a lot of joy in that. But what there's not supposed to be is toil and pain. Those are the result of the fall. So God was ordaining a rest, a day of rest, so that we could be reminded, this is what we were created for. We were created to walk in God's works and in the perfection that He has already made. We can see a little bit more fully how God intended for the Sabbath to be kept in Isaiah chapter 58, which is my go-to scripture for people who think we should be keeping one day a week still, or keeping it in the way that the Israelites were required to. I'm like, okay, you want to know what God wanted? What did God really want from the Israelites in terms of keeping the Sabbath? We're still in the Old Testament. We've not gotten to the New Testament. What was it that he desired for Israel to do to honor his holy day? Isaiah 58, starting in verse 13. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath. I've never really known what that meant, but I think what God had in mind was if you stop trampling on it. I think that's why I use the word foot. It's like you're trampling on my holy day. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord and honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words. Then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high hills of the earth, and feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. So it's quite clear that the observance that God had in mind, even in the Old Testament, had to do with their ceasing from their own works. That is to say that he wanted them not to pursue their own pleasures, their own ideas, their own thoughts, but to honor him by pursuing him, by seeking him. And this continued into the new covenant, expanded and illuminated by Jesus Christ himself. There is no one who ever fulfilled the Sabbath like Jesus. There is no one who ever lived their life not finding their own pleasure, speaking their own words, or doing their own ways. No one has ever done that as fully or as completely as Jesus Christ did. And we could spend all day looking at this. But I wanted to go to just a couple of prophecies, first of all, which told what the Messiah, what his life would look like. And you can follow along here if you want and not if you want. It's just a few verses in each place. But the first one is in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 22. And David said to Solomon in verse 7, "My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name, because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to you, who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies all around. His name shall be Solomon, for I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever.'" Now, of course, we know that this was a prophecy specific to Solomon. It was fulfilled in Solomon, but not entirely. Because Solomon's throne, his own personal reign, was not established over Israel forever. That's not fulfilled until Jesus came. So part of this prophecy applies to Solomon, and the entire thing applies to Jesus, that he would be a man of rest. You think of the life of our Savior and what characterized him, his disposition, how he walked through the circumstances of his life, extremely stressful circumstances that none of us can even imagine having that kind, literally the weight of the world on his shoulders. He knew he was going to the cross. He was surrounded by people who wanted to kill him, wanted to trap him. He had a traitor in his ranks and knew it from the time that he chose his disciples. And yet, he was not a stressed person. He was a man of rest. He was holiness itself confronted by wickedness on a daily basis. How did he handle that? How did the prophet say he would handle it? Isaiah 42. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my elect one, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out, nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail, nor be discouraged, till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands shall wait for his law. So Jesus was a man of rest. He did not have to go around in the streets shouting. He had trust in his Father. It was his Father's works that he did. He did not feel like, I've got to straighten out everybody and everything. He even said to the Pharisees at one point, I have a lot more things to say and to judge of you, but I'm not saying them because I only speak what my Father's given me to speak. You know, having a kind of a perfectionist brain, it's hard for me to like see a picture crooked on the wall and not straighten it. But can you imagine how Jesus, being perfect, must have felt about being confronted with sin morning, noon, and night in everyone's life? Couldn't he have just spent his life saying, no, 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 that's wrong. You're wrong. You're confused. Let me straighten that out for you. No, that's a wrong attitude. Let me rebuke that. I mean, he could have spent his whole life doing this. And he could have just gone out in the streets shouting about everything that was wrong. But that isn't what characterized his life. It was rest. Because he only had to do what God gave him to do. He didn't have to straighten out every person in the world. He had to walk in obedience to his Father. And that's what we're supposed to be about also. Another prophecy of Isaiah, which is appropriate to the day, is the 9th chapter, found in the 9th chapter. Pages will unstick. Beginning in the 6th verse, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. The Israelites understood, the prophets understood, that Messiah was going to bring peace. They didn't know exactly how it was going to happen. And Jesus himself said, don't think that I've come to bring peace. I tell you no, but rather division. Because at that time, he was coming to bear our sin and to bring out the hearts, to reveal the hearts. It was not the time for peace to come. But that was still his mission. The ultimate goal that God had in mind was to bring us back to that perfect creation, to that Sabbath rest that he had instituted. That's what he sent his son to do. And because this is Christmas Eve, we just really have to read some from Luke 2. And it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This census first took place while Quirinius was governing Syria. So all went to be registered, everyone to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth into Judea to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. So it was that while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered, and she brought forth her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. Now there were in the same country shepherds living out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood before them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were greatly afraid. Then the angel said to them, do not be afraid, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which will be to all people. For there is born to you this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord. And this will be the sign to you. You will find a babe wrapped in swaddling cloths lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. I was standing out in the field yesterday afternoon, and one of the things you notice about winter is it's really, really quiet because most of the animals are in hibernation and there's just not as much activity generally. And if you live in the country like we do, it's really quiet, even in the middle of the day. You can just stand there and close your eyes and not hear anything. And it was really, really peaceful. And I think that God intended for this time of the year also to be a reminder to us. I think he actually gives a little bit of this every year. I experience it anyway around Christmas time. Just once again to remind us, this is what I sent my son to bring you. It's not that we deserve it, but that's what he wants to give us because he's love, because he's mercy, because he's gracious. He sent his son into the middle of our war, as it were, our rebellion, to bring us peace. So that's how he came, and how did he live? Probably the best example from the life of Christ that we could point to that shows how perfectly at rest he was is found in Mark chapter 4. Sorry. And I'm going to begin in verse 35. On the same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was, and other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. Why was Jesus sleeping? Was it because, as the disciples thought, he didn't care? Jesus was sleeping because he knew there was no danger. Because in reality, he didn't need to be awake at that time. There wasn't anything for him to do. This is a picture of the kind of rest that is available to us. I wonder, I don't know how many of us will ever experience this kind of rest in our lives, where in the middle of the most threatening circumstance that even threatens us with death, we could, like Jesus, lie down and go to sleep. There is this childlike simplicity to the faith that Jesus had, the trust that he had in his Father. It wasn't his time. It wasn't his time to go. Therefore, nothing was going to happen. It didn't matter if there was a great windstorm. So what? God was the one who was going to determine the hour at which his death would occur. But he knew that this was not that hour, so he could sleep. He was in the stern, asleep on a pillow, and they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?" Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. This is how he lived, to draw us into the peace that he had inside him. And this is something that he can do in us, is to give us this peace that other people look at and say, "What is the matter with you? Why are you not freaking out? Don't you realize the world is going to hell in a handbasket? Don't you realize who just got elected? Don't you realize who controls the court? Don't you realize the law that they just made? Don't you realize this diagnosis? Don't you realize this, that, and the other?" Yes. And also realize who my Father is. Jesus was not drawn by the circumstance into the fear and panic of those around him. You know how infectious fear is? when somebody wakes you up out of a dead sleep and says, we're going to die. Well, even if you weren't scared, you would be at that point because it's contagious. It's like, oh my, we are going to die. Well, why was I sleeping? What's going on here? Not Jesus. His rest, his peace in his Father was so perfect that he was like, what's the problem again? Why did you wake me up? Oh, the waves. Oh, be quiet. And then I would imagine he probably went back to sleep. Because that's how much peace there was inside him, because of perfect trust in his Father. He never left the place of rest. His whole life was one long Sabbath, undisturbed. And why? You know where stress actually comes from? Stress is, physically speaking, stress hormones are the body responding to stimuli from the mind, getting ready to do something. Only most of the time, there's actually not anything we can do. But still, the adrenal glands are getting triggered, and they're going, okay, we're going to have to fight. We're going to have to run. We're going to do something here. So get ready, you know, get revved. And we're sitting on just revving and not never doing anything. So this is why worry and stress are so toxic, because the things that God put in the body to enable us to do stuff aren't actually being used to do anything but eat ourselves up with stress and worry. Jesus knew the secret of trusting perfectly in his Father's finished work, such that he did not feel responsible for the outcome of anything. Stress comes from feeling responsible for the outcome of things, and therefore it's actually based on a lie, because we're actually not responsible for anything but to obey God. Which doesn't take effort, it takes yieldedness. So if we're yielded to him in everything, then there's no more reason for stress. It's kind of interesting, actually, if you take the word stress, and if you're taking notes, you can write it down so you can see what I'm talking about. S-T-R-E-S-S. Begins and ends with an S. I think of S as standing for self. So cross out the S at the beginning, cross out the S at the end, and then take that T, which looks kind of like the cross, and move it to the end to symbolize Christ's finished work. What do you have?
Rest.
You have rest. In other words, if we take ourselves out of the equation and realize it doesn't begin and end with me, it begins and ends with God. Jesus Christ is the Alpha and the Omega. He started the work. He's finishing the work. So you take self out and you put the cross as the finish. That was where Jesus said it's finished. That's rest. It's not my problem. I'm not the one that decided there was going to be a storm. I'm not the one that's responsible to do something about the fact that there's a storm. I'm just here in this boat because God told me to be here in this boat. So I think I'll take a nap because there's nothing to worry about. One of the great ironies of the life of Jesus is that even though his life embodied a keeping of the Sabbath in a way that no one had ever kept it before or ever would again, perfect rest and trust in his Father, this was the very point on which his enemies most consistently attacked him. It's quite interesting that there were six of those attacks. I was counting them up today across the four Gospels, like the 6 days labor. It's like the work of man attacking the finished work of God. You see, there were these guys called the Pharisees, and they had decided that the problem, all the problems that had happened to Israel and the reason that they kept getting booted out of their land and coming under the domination of foreign dictators, was because they weren't keeping the law properly. So what they needed to do was figure out how to keep the law with absolute perfection, and then God would be pleased. But they didn't really study the prophets. They just went back and looked at the Torah. That was where they spent most of their time. Torah. No. The Pentateuch, anyway. The Torah is actually the whole thing, but the Pentateuch is what they studied. And so they didn't get any illumination on these commandments. They just got death. They got legalism. They got legalism to a degree that you would find absolutely laughable, and it would be laughable if it was not so serious. You can actually see this today in Orthodox Judaism, because the Orthodox Jews are basically the intellectual, spiritual heirs of the Pharisees. And they have actually taken the commands regarding the Sabbath and reversed them effectively in their effects, the way that they observe the Sabbath. For instance, rather famously, Jews will not use an elevator on the Sabbath because it requires a spark. It's electricity. They have to have all their electricity off on the Sabbath. And an elevator is electric, so can't use the elevator. We have to climb the stairs. So if you're a Jew living in Brooklyn and you happen to live on the 15th floor and it's the Sabbath, you know, sorry, you just got to climb 15 flights of stairs. And we just look at this and say, how could you possibly think that this is the right way to observe the Sabbath, is to labor up 15 flights of stairs? And God is looking down and saying, I am so pleased you are resting just the way I intended, climbing those 15 flights of stairs. This is how blind human beings become when we try to achieve righteousness by the law instead of by faith. We end up doing the opposite of what God commanded. And this is what they were doing. They had made all these absurd regulations about what you could and could not do on the Sabbath to avoid supposedly working and breaking it. One of the laws that they had was that you could spit, but it had to be on a rock. Because if you spit on the ground, that makes clay. Clay is mortar. And making mortar is work. So no spitting on the ground, have to spit on the rock. Interesting fact, when Jesus healed the blind man in John, I thought I had the reference, yeah, John chapter 9, it specifically says he spit on the ground and made clay of the spittle and anointed the eyes of the blind man. He was, as it were, putting it in their face and saying, this is what I think of all the stuff that you've added to my Father's commandments to make yourself seem righteous. I'm taking the very thing that you say is breaking the law and using it to do my Father's works. It was on the Sabbath that he did that. It was one of six times that they reproached him for doing something on the Sabbath. They got all tied in knots about what Jesus did on the Sabbath. And what was his response? I want to look at John chapter 5. I don't want to go on too long, so I'm not going to read this whole story. I think we're mostly familiar with it. This is the story of Jesus healing the man at the pool of Siloam. And I'll just start in verse 8. Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed and walked, and that day was the Sabbath. You think that was a coincidence? That was not a coincidence. God intended for Jesus to do these works on the Sabbath to show up their fallacious, hypocritical thinking. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed." What? I mean, this is like you go down to the street corner and there's a guy in a wheelchair and everybody knows he's been in a wheelchair for years and years and years, and you say, "In the name of Jesus, get up and walk." And he gets up and walks and goes walking across the street, and the policeman who saw the whole thing says, "Ah, jaywalking. You can't do that." He's just healed a crippled man who's been crippled for 38 years. And all they can say is, it's the Sabbath, can't carry your bed. Where were their heads? In their own righteousness. Because to them, this was righteous, not only to keep these ridiculous legalistic commandments that they made up themselves, but to make everyone else do it. To the point that they couldn't even see the goodness of God. It was right in front of them. Someone had just been healed, for crying out loud. And the only thing they could think about was, you broke the Sabbath. Broke the Sabbath. He celebrated the Sabbath. He came to bring rest. And he brought healing to someone who had been crippled. This was the perfect way to observe the Sabbath. They didn't understand it because they didn't understand what it was. They did not understand that this was about God's works and about celebrating God's works and doing God's works. They thought it was some kind of suffocating rule that, oh, it's the Sabbath, you have to sit in a chair and wear black clothes and have a long face and think on God. And that's not what it was about at all. He answered them, "He who made me well said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" Then they asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk?'" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you've been made well. Sin no more, lest a worse thing come upon you." The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Why? Why was this such a big deal to them? This was the one thing that they consistently said. As a matter of fact, in the other story that we're not going to read, where he healed the blind man, they said, "This man is not of God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath." And there was a division among them because of it. Because they had elevated this to this point in their minds that they just couldn't get past it. It's like, he's not keeping the Sabbath. What is going on here? He can't be healing people because he's not keeping the Sabbath. Because he was bringing their whole house of cards crashing down. Everything that they had built their life and religion on, all of these outward observances, Jesus was saying, none of that matters. None of it counts. Because you're not following God by faith. You're not looking for the righteousness that comes by believing on the one whom the Father has sent. You're blind and you're in darkness, and they couldn't stand it. And that's why they wanted to kill him. Not because they were so zealous for the Sabbath, because they loved the Sabbath so much. They made regulations to get around their own regulations. You couldn't walk more than a mile from your home. "Well, I'll just put a little stuff here, a mile from my house, and I'll call that my second home, and then I'll be able to walk 2 miles. It was ridiculous. I mean, they really didn't care about the Sabbath. They cared about having their own righteousness. And when Jesus came along and stripped away the cloak for their sin, they're like, "He's got to go. We got to kill him." For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." Therefore, the Jews sought all the more to kill him because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Then Jesus answered and said to them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do, for whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner." The interesting thing about this is that all the Jews said that God was their Father. This was a common formula that they used in prayer around the time of Christ. They called God Abba, which is in term of endearment for your Father. When Jesus said it, it was different. The justification that Jesus gave for why it was okay for him to work on the Sabbath, it's interesting he didn't even bother blowing up all their phony definitions of what breaking the Sabbath was. He could have, but he didn't. He kind of went straight to the heart of it. He said, "My Father has been working until now." His defense of his working on the Sabbath is basically the works weren't his. They were God's. So what he was saying is, the Son could do nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do. I'm just walking in God's works. Because there's nothing in the law that says God can't work on the Sabbath. It says man can't work. It doesn't say God can't. God took a day of rest at the beginning of creation, and he's been working ever since. The rest is for us. It's not for him. And what Jesus is saying is, you take it up with him. These are God's works. They're not mine. What are you complaining about? I'm going around healing people. You know, the rabbis had to come up with this justification because during the Maccabean revolts, which were prior to the time of Christ, the enemies of the Jews figured out that they wouldn't fight on the Sabbath. And there were massacres that happened as a result of that, that they would just come in and kill them all because they believed it wasn't even allowed for them to defend themselves. And the rabbis said, "Whoa, we got a problem." So they put their heads together and they finally decided it was okay to even kill someone on the Sabbath in defense of life. It had to be in defense of life. So when Jesus asked them, "Is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath to save life or to kill?" he was actually talking about the rabbinical ruling that they said it was actually all right to kill someone. But what they were saying is, it's okay to kill someone, but you can't heal someone. So it's like, how do you get your head around that? They had it all twisted because they missed the whole point of the fourth commandment, to keep the Sabbath holy, because it's about God. It's about God's works. And this is what Jesus was bringing back to them and saying, my Father is the one who's working. Not me. This is not me doing my own stuff this is God's works that I'm walking in. So I want to go back to Exodus 20 and look at another aspect of this commandment that kind of shows us, I think it sort of wraps this up. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. It's very interesting to me that God bothered to list 6 categories of people and animals that were not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And you can actually see that this is, in a Jewish mind, in descending order of importance. You, I'm not including that in the 6, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your animals, and, oh, by the way, even the Gentiles. Don't make them work underneath the animals, thanks. So, what God was saying, I think, is that this rest is not just for you, this rest is for everyone. In my research this morning, I was noticing that in the various traditions, days of rest that were instituted in other cultures, for instance, the Romans had a day of rest. It was actually only for patricians, that is, the rich guys. They got a day off. The poor people didn't get one. Babylonians had special rules on their days of rest for the common man. Common man was not allowed to make a wish on a day of rest, which is kind of weird to me. How would anyone possibly enforce that? But the point being, there were different rules depending on what class of society you were in. And the Pharisees almost kind of implemented this under the Jewish law, because in order to keep the Sabbath the way they said you had to keep it, you almost had to be wealthy. But that wasn't how God envisioned it. That wasn't how God intended it. And once again, we're leading into the 6 commandments that talk about our relationships with one another. And he's saying, everyone is on an equal footing. Because I finished the work, because I made the heavens and the earth, because I did all this, you all partake equally of my goodness. So whether it's you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your animals, or the Gentiles, nobody needs to work. Because you all need to understand, it's all grace. And we will finish up in Hebrews, if you want to turn there. In the 4th chapter. I'm sorry, we're going to start in the 3rd chapter and finish in the 4th. Verse 7 of chapter 3. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end, while it is said today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who having heard rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Now with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see that they could not enter in because of unbelief. Why were the disciples panicked in the boat? Why did they wake Jesus up? Because they lacked faith. He said, why were you so fearful? how is it that you do not have faith? It takes faith to take hold of God's rest. He's talking about the children of Israel who came out of Egypt with Moses, had seen all of God's works, got to the edge of the promised land, and they said, no, we're not going in. We'd rather go back to Egypt. Because they did not believe God. Because they did not trust him. They had not grasped the fact that God had already provided it. It's like, we want to go back to what we know. I do this thing and I get this result. I work all day and I get my leeks and garlics. That's predictable. I feel safe with that. I'm in control of that. You're saying, go into the promised land and I'll give you power to conquer these giants and somehow you're going to survive and the cities are going to fall down and I'm just going to give you this land that you didn't work for. A likely story. I think you want to kill us. Lack of faith. That is why they missed it. Because they would rather have their minimum wage job than be made a prince or a princess in the kingdom of God and simply receive all of his goodness. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear, lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. For we who have believed do enter that rest, as he has said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. In other words, everything has already been done. The Bible calls Jesus the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. When God said it's good, he meant it's good. I've already provided it all. Your problem is that you're not here to enjoy it. Your problem is that you're off trying to do for yourself and provide for yourself and be in control yourself instead of just coming and receiving everything that I have for you. And this is why he gave us the Sabbath. This is why he gave us all of these words of life, to remember he's already provided for it. All we have to do is show up, wearing the robe of righteousness that he provided, cleansed in the blood, trusting in him, and not adding anything of our own. For he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this place, they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time, as it has been said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. There remains therefore a rest for the people of God, for he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works, as God did from his. This is what the fourth commandment is all about. To keep the Sabbath is to cease from our own works. Plain and simple. Only we're invited not to just do it once a week, as the Israelites did, but every single day. And this is why I say to people who tell me that they believe they should be keeping the Sabbath, I agree with you. I just don't think you're keeping it enough. One day a week is nice. How about 7 days a week? How about on Monday afternoon, Tuesday morning, and Wednesday evening? How about all the time, not a word comes out of my mouth of myself, but I'm speaking his words. I don't pursue my pleasures. I pursue what brings him pleasure. I honor him in all that I do. That's how he wanted it to be kept from the very beginning. And now he's thrown the door open and said they wouldn't enter in. Just like the parable of the wedding, the first guests, they wouldn't come. They had their own stuff going on. So he went and got the Gentiles who were underneath the animals and said, hey, you guys come. This is for you too. Come. Have a part in my Sabbath. Enter my rest. And take all that I've provided for you.